First to an anniversary of a behind-the-scenes achiever that's really contributed to the strengths of our Asian region. But it's worthwhile casting your mind back to the 1960s, when the area was going through immense changes. China was in the midst of the Cultural Revolution, Vietnam was entering its bloody civil war, Malaysia was beginning as an independent country, though in conflict with its neighbour Indonesia, and India and Pakistan were still struggling with the after effects of partition. And of course, the Cold War was ever present. Through all of this, the Asian Development Bank was formed in late 1966, bringing together 31 countries to boost economic ties and cooperation. An incredible feat considering the times. 50 years on, the ADB is still operating, but facing new challenges. So what are they? And what has the bank achieved to date? Anne-Marie O'Keefe, with her colleagues, have interviewed over 60 ADB stakeholders from around the world, pored over all their stats, and emerged with some major recommendations for the bank in the future. Anne-Marie is the former Australian ambassador to Nepal. She's chair of Australia's National Commission for UNESCO. She's a non-resident fellow at the Lowy Institute, and it's for that institute that this report's been prepared and written. Anne-Marie, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Oh, lovely to be here. Thank you.
After 12 months of studying the bank, you conclude there's still a need for it, despite many of the Asian countries moving from that developing stage to emerge. Now, why is it still needed then?
One of the big problems almost for Asia is that the publicity has been too good. The headlines about its economic performance, I mean, for example, the IMF itself, sees Asia in two decades having greater GDP than the US and Europe combined. And that's just in two decades. Already it accounts for 40% of the world's GDP. So why does it need a thing like the Asian Development Bank? Well, the reality is that almost half the world's extreme poor, and I'm saying extreme poor, still live in Asia. So there is still a real need for a publicly sponsored development bank to support the region in addressing the big challenges that it has to.
Yeah, it does your head in a little bit, this, because I read the other day that something like 85%, I think it was, or 80 to 85% of the world's current slaves come from the Asian region. So it's just sort of flies in the face of this notion that it's all powering ahead in an equal fashion, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the world has been very successful in reducing poverty. But, you know, we're still looking at something like 800 million overall globally being extremely poor. And when I say extremely poor, I'm saying people who live on less than $1.90 a day. So, you know, those who live on $2 a day, they're not being counted. Mm. So we're still looking at a lot of poverty, and half of that's in Asia.
Could we go back to the beginning? How did this bank come about during those incredibly turbulent times that I listed?
It was one of those things that came out of World War II. You'll recall that the world decided to create institutions like the World Bank and the IMF, etc. That was coming out of World War II. And there was a recognition by the early 60s that Asia also needed a dedicated regional bank to support it. You've already listed a large number of the big issues that the region was facing. I mean, the wars, the turmoil, the post-colonial days as well, all of that came together.
Who were the initial backers?
Well, we were. Australia was. Right. America very much. Right. And Japan was very keen to play a leading role in this, again, in part because attempting to address the impact of its actions during World War II.
Its headquarters are based in Manila, yet all of its presidents have come from Japan. So how does it work with the member states? Is it population or economic size that holds more sway?
It's a bit of both. Both Japan and the US have the highest share of votes in the bank. They are also the two countries that on a comparative basis provide the most, or promise to provide the most, in terms of capital funding. It's one of those legacy issues from post-World War II. It's a little bit like only Americans have ever been the presidents of the World Bank. Only Europeans have ever been the head of IMF. There's a bit of a tradition here. There's increasing agitation that this should change. But, you know, I'm frankly of the view that having Japan providing the president of the bank actually provides some stability, which for a big institution like that isn't a bad thing. The only thing I'd like them to do is actually change the gender occasionally.
Okay. So, yeah, Japan and the US, your report points out, have the dominant shareholder positions, which is interesting. But you make the point that the bank ought to remain and does remain at the moment neutral in what is an increasingly fraught political environment. I mean, the South China Sea is just part of it. So, I mean, is this a tricky dance?
They've been pretty successful at doing it to date. And part of the reason they've been successful is that member countries have actually respected that neutrality. In our report, we make a plea almost to the member states to maintain that position. You know, there could be a temptation on the part of either China or on the part of the US to use the bank as another forum for playing out what they're currently playing out in terms of the strategic tensions. We ask them not to, because it's actually going to go against both their interests if the bank finds itself in an untenable position trying to work between these two major forces within the bank.
So maybe if you helped us understand what the bank actually does for the people concerned, so because we've discussed the structure, could you give us some examples of what the bank's greatest achievements have been, would you say, in, I presume, alleviating poverty in these last 50 years?
Oh, alleviating poverty is such a broad term. What the bank has brought to the collective effort to deal with poverty has been its emphasis on infrastructure. Very important if you're going to deal with poverty to actually bring in the sorts of services and infrastructure like roads, like telecommunications, like schools, the building of schools, the building of universities, all those things that we take so much for granted here. We might complain about it, but in actual fact, we have it. And many of the countries, particularly in the 60s and 70s and even in the 80s, were struggling to get that level of infrastructure that you need to ensure that the whole of society is starting to receive some sort of benefits.
And is it a bit like, you know, our Clean Energy Finance Corporation, say, which says that it partners, it actually provides capital to people who otherwise don't get it through banks, the normal banks, because they're sort of, looking for new technology or whatever. Now, is it like that? Does the development bank actually twin with existing partners, or does it provide all the money?
It's a variety of all of that. Basically, traditionally, it's been the lender to sovereign nations.
Oh, I see.
So country X needs to build a series of highways in a province. It will go to the Asian Development Bank. The Asian Development Bank will look at the situation. Often we'll come up with the design, we'll come up with the way in which it should be implemented, and then we'll provide, as a loan, the money required to actually construct the whatever it is that's been required.
I see. So it's almost like a banker of last resort to sovereign governments.
Oh, I don't think it would want to be called the banker of last resort, although probably increasingly it's becoming that. But you have to remember that particularly in the latter part of the 20th century, there wasn't the same amount of capital, financial resources around. And so it was really hard for countries to find access to the money they
needed. Let me tell this is Anne-Marie O'Keefe is joining us. She's participated in a report for the Lowy Institute on the 50 years of the Asian Development Bank, which we're learning all about. Are we in it, by the way?
Oh, yes, yeah. We're the fifth most important member of the Asian Development Bank. Yes, we're there. We're absolutely there.
It's amazing
there.
We haven't talked about it more, isn't it? I mean, we've talked about these new, particularly the two new banks, the New Development Bank and the Asian Infrastructure Bank, which was a big political issue. So how would you say these two new big boys on the block are affecting the ADB?
Well, it's the AIIB, the Chinese bank, that is the one that really has caused the ripples, in part because of the geostrategic tensions in East Asia. But the heads of both banks have recognised that there's a real opportunity here for them to cooperate. Firstly, AIIB shocked everybody, including the Chinese, by getting so many members from the West. You know, David Cameron, when he was Prime Minister, shocked Obama by saying, well, we're actually going to join the AIIB. Australia's there. Canada is likely to become a member this year. So you've got this bank that's got now a lot of expectation riding on its shoulders. It doesn't have that many projects yet. Projects take a long time to develop. Mm. It actually needs the Asian Development Bank as a cooperative partner so that they can find comparative advantages themselves and work together.
Just final quick question. If it didn't exist, would we notice? I'm not trying to be trite, but I'm trying to give people sort of a sense how we should be celebrating this more.
Well, you know, not one institution or one country can claim credit for the really significant reduction in poverty. It's a combination, it's a collective effort. And if it wasn't there, we would probably see we weren't as successful as we could have been, but we'll never know.
Mm. Okay, Anne-Marie. Very interesting and something we clearly ought to be applauding more. It's one of these sort of structures that gets sort of lost along the way because it doesn't sound as exciting as others. Thank you for joining us.
Ah, pleasure.
Anne-Marie O'Keefe. She's done this report for the Lowy Institute, where she's a non-resident fellow. It's called Strengthening the Asian Development Bank in the 21st Century Asia. And we've put a link to the report on our website.